Rohrabacher's district is one of four congressional seats in the OC. The Democrats are eyeing in their bid to retake the House of Representatives in November.
The top two finishers in Tuesday's primary will advance to the runoff.
Newsom tends to be backed by suburbanites and liberals. Villaraigosa has strong support among many Latinos and lower-income voters, and Cox polls well with whites and men.
KCW's Cherry Glazer, Daryl Satzman, and Jenny Hamill reporting in the weeks leading up to tomorrow's statewide primary election. That is tomorrow. Our show today devoted to covering that election. I'm Madeline Brand.
And I'm Steve Chiotakis. California's jungle primary is turning the governor's race into a race for second place. Polls show Democrat Gavin Newsom far out in front. And so the real action is for the number two spot. The top two finishers go on to the November general election. A handful of candidates have broken away from the crowded field. And Madeline, you sat down with all six of them, didn't
you? I did sit down with all six of them, four Democrats, two Republicans. We sat down for about 20-minute interviews over the last few weeks. And I asked them about some big issues, including housing, homelessness, immigration, education.
Well, let's start with the three men who seem to have the best chance of coming out ahead tomorrow. That's Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom, former L.A. Mayor Antonio Villaraigosa, both Democrats, and Republican businessman John Cox. And Newsom is making a lot of big promises, Madeline, in his campaign. 500,000 housing units every year, single-payer health care, universal pre-K. How did he tell you he'd get it all done?
Well, he is certainly promising a lot, and he didn't have actually fine-grained details in terms of how he would accomplish all of those goals. We talked about housing, 500,000 units every year for the next 7 years. That's what he wants. And by the way, that's more than the state has ever built in its modern history by a long shot. But in our interview, he said, hey, it's about setting big goals.
It is profoundly audacious, correct?
And that you were going to hold you to that number? Is that
no,
a number we should hold you to?
No, because I don't, with respect, that's sort of the usual politicking. Here's my point being, be audacious. Because in the process of being audacious, you'll discover what you're capable of being. So hold me account to being audacious. And in the process, doing more than we've ever done.
Okay, so that's his goal, to be audacious. And
hey, he didn't want to be pinned on that number,
did
he?
He's not going to be pinned on that 500,000 figure. So, you know, basically, though, there was a recent bill that Assemblywoman Scott Wiener introduced, which would have built more housing around transportation centers, and he said he was against that.
So, yes.
So we don't really know what he would be for or against if he were elected governor.
There's also the idea, of course, a single-payer system, healthcare system that's been gaining steam in Sacramento. Newsom says he is for it, but a state legislative assessment put that price tag at a daunting $400 billion, more than twice the state budget. So how does this get paid for?
Yeah, well, he didn't have specifics for that either, but he said, look, this is more of a transition problem than one with a big price tag. Let's listen to our exchange.
How do you go from one system to a new system? And how do you mine that gap?
Okay. But, I mean, you do have to be honest with the taxpayers that there could be a tax increase. Might be offset with the fewer health insurance premiums and the deductibles and all that you're talking about. But there would be a tax increase in one of the highest tax states of the union.
Well, the point is, I want to bring down the cost of health care. And the only evidence in the world suggests that a single-payer financing system is a way of achieving that.
Okay, so again, big plans, not a lot of specifics on how he'd get that done.
This is most politicians do it that way, correct?
Mm-hmm.
So with Newsom solidly leading the pack, Madeline, this has really become a race for, as we said at the outset, that second place spot between Republican John Cox and former L.A. Mayor Antonio Villaraigosa. Can you tell us a little bit about John Cox? Because he's sort of the mystery candidate,
right? A lot of people have no idea who he is. A lot of people who aren't following politics closely. Cox has only lived in California for about a decade or so. He ran for office a few times in Illinois. He never won until recently, funding his own campaign. He's fairly wealthy. And I asked him why, as a newer resident here and as a Republican in a Democratic state, he thought he is the best person to lead California.
I finally moved out here to join the rest of my family. And
what took you so long?
I had to save up enough money to buy a house out here. It's pretty expensive. That's one of the reasons I'm running, Madeline.
Well, I was going to ask you that as my second question. Why do you think, with only 10 years in the state under your belt, do you think you're qualified to run for the state's highest office?
I've been following California for a long, much longer than that. But The big issue here is the unaffordability of the state. The people of the state cannot afford their house. They can't afford their gasoline, their water, their electricity. I want to do something about that.
Okay. And so he got the endorsement of Donald Trump, by the way. He admitted he didn't vote for him in the last presidential election.
Said he wished he could.
Yes, but he didn't. But he is sort of falling in line now with Donald Trump's priorities, including supporting a border wall, repealing the state's new sanctuary law, and just being tougher on immigration in general.
Among the two Republicans in the race, Madeline, California's new sanctuary law has really helped them rev up the GOP base here. Why did John Cox say he was against the state sanctuary law?
Well, he's painted it as a crime issue, a safety issue. He says the state is less safe with this new law. He said the same thing about why he's in favor of the border wall. And so I asked him, though, about statistics that show that crime overall in the state is pretty low. And let's listen to that exchange.
You know, you can tell that to the family of Anthony Mealy, who was sitting in a restaurant in Ventura, holding his five-year-old daughter on his lap when a homeless person came up and sliced his neck and killed him. You know, even
right,
one murder like that
is
horrendous.
Yes.
Well, it's horrendous, though, and we're doing no favors to people.
But what does that have to do with immigration?
Well, it doesn't, but it's a crime. You and I talked about crime. And I think people are still worried about crime in their communities, and if you talk about crime in San Francisco, a significant number of break-ins of cars occurring on the streets.
I guess no. I was actually referring to the border wall, and then you're saying that would prevent crime. And
we shifted to talking about crime in general. But you know, listen, again, the border wall is all about securing us from drugs and guns, and you know, MS-13 and human trafficking. And again, even if it's a small number, I think the job of government is to protect us.
That's John Cox, of course, speaking to Madeline. You talked to Villaraigosa as well. He is very pro-immigration, like the rest of the Democrats in the race in general. There's not a huge gap between him and Gavin Newsom, the frontrunner. Villaraigosa also says, though, that he wants to build 500,000 houses a year. What's an area where they differ?
Well, education, for one.
Really?
Villaraigosa, as you remember, when he was mayor, he took on the teachers' unions very forcefully, and he is seen as the pro-charter school candidate. He's receiving a lot of money from pro-charter organizations, including Netflix CEO Reed Hastings, former New York City mayor Michael Bloomberg, Eli Broad, the philanthropist. But he told me those big donors would not necessarily influence him if he's elected governor.
The teachers union spent $1.8 million to get me elected in 2001 and 2005. They did because they wanted me to become governor one day. And I took on, you know, a broken school district that was failing kids. One out of three schools were failing. We had a 44% graduation rate. So I was willing to challenge even my friends, that had contributed a lot to get me elected. And the same is true with charter schools.
Okay. It should be noted, Steve, that he has received some $20 million from a pro-charter PAC. So that's a lot of money.
He's been running a lot of spots, right? Even over the weekend.
A lot of spots in favor of him and in favor of some other candidates as well. And so, but Newsom, of course, has backing of the teachers union and money from the teachers union as well.
All right. So Villaraigosa, despite his years in public office as mayor of L.A., and before that up in Sacramento as the assembly speaker, he is struggling, Madeline, to secure the number two spot. He certainly has the name recognition.
Right.
What did Villaraigosa have to say about his low polling numbers?
Well, he kind of dismissed them as a temporary problem. He says he expects Latinos to turn out for him tomorrow and tilt the race in his favor.
You know, the one group that historically doesn't vote in the numbers that others do is the Latino community. In fact, in 1,100 races since 2001, they've only voted their numbers in the electorate four times. That's the bad news. The good news is that three of them were for me.
Okay, and he's been campaigning in places where a lot of Latinos live and work, the Central Valley, the Inland Empire, trying to energize them to go out and vote.
And we'll see if that strategy works for him. Yeah, if they do get out and vote. There's another Democrat in the race who has a smaller, though admittedly not impossible, chance of also being in the top two, and this is State Treasurer John Chung. What is his main issue in this race?
Well, he paints himself as the fiscal adult in the room, as sort of like an heir to Jerry Brown in terms of fiscal constraint. You know, he was he's State Treasurer, he was the controller, and he really pointed to his money management skills.
I'm the most successful auditor in California history. As a state controller, I did $9.5 billion of audit findings. I audited colleges who were misusing dollars. I've been able to refinance the state's borrowing. Think of your student loans. Think of your credit card. Think of your mortgage. Wouldn't you rather have that at lower interest rates? For the next few decades, I've saved Californians over $7 billion. Smart money thinking that people do on a daily basis, the state needs to do so that we can have additional monies to pay for education and healthcare and infrastructure.
All right, so that was John Chung. Rounding out the race is Republican Assemblyman Travis Allen and former state school superintendent of public instruction, as it's called, Delaine Easton, a Democrat. And aside, Madeline, from being the only woman in the race in an era when more women than ever are getting involved in politics nationwide, how has Delaine Easton tried to set herself apart from the others?
Well, she paints herself as the Bernie Sanders type candidate in this race. So she's pro-universal free state education, higher education. She wants to repeal the current law that limits rent control in California cities known as Costa Hawkins. That'll be on the ballot in November.
The proof of the pudding is in the eating, and we have way too many. We have foreign countries buying up housing to turn them into B&Bs and to turn them into short-term rentals so they can make lots and lots of money and ships out of the country. It's crazy.
Now, many economists think rent control is not the solution because it acts as a disincentive to creating new housing. I mean, it's great for people who have rent control apartments, but for everyone else, it makes housing more expensive because there isn't an incentive to build a lot of housing if it's going to be rent controlled.
That's exactly the rationale that was used to pass Costa Hawkins in 1995, and the situation has gotten much worse.
Okay, so, and all the other candidates in the race are either against it or skeptical that strengthening rent control is a great idea. Again, that will be on the ballot in November for voters to decide.
All right. And then there is Travis Allen. He is sort of running as the pro-Trump Republican, really embracing the president despite not getting the president's endorsement. He wants to repeal the state sanctuary law. He is a pro-border wall. He wants to bring tougher voter ID laws to California. This is, of course, the Republican mantra these days. How does he say he would work with state lawmakers, which are overwhelmingly Democrat, in Sacramento?
Well, the short answer is basically he won't. Yeah. He's not even going to bother. He will put most of his policies up to the voters to decide by ballot initiative.
The sort of major reforms that California needs will never be passed by the California Democrats. We must take these directly to the people of California.
So why have elected representatives at all? Why not just do everything by ballot initiative?
Well, you know, clearly we have a government to run and the legislature serves a very real purpose. We, you know, we must have, you know, a balance of power in all levels of government. The problem with the California legislature is it's entirely dominated by the California Democrats. So what they've given us are not only these excessively high taxes, but all the crazy laws that we have now in California, which is why as an ex-governor of California, I'll have the ability to veto these laws.
And Steve, you might remember that former Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger once tried that move. He tried to govern through ballot initiative with a few measures. It just didn't work.
Did not work out for him.
Well, no. You know, voters rejected those ballot measures.
We have somebody in the studio who actually knows a lot about ballot measures and about the ballot in general. Paul Mitchell, who's vice president of Political Data Incorporated, which provides a lot of polling data to Democrats and to Republican campaigns as well. At least some of the Republican candidates, Paul, are following the president. They're sticking, as you heard, to these hardline immigration policies. Is that a winning strategy for them?
Well, it is in the primary. And the fact is that voters who cast ballots on the Republican side of the ticket in the primary, be them Republicans or independents that are really conservative, they support the president. The popularity for Donald Trump among that population is around 90% favorable.
And yet Republicans are polling now, as far as registered Republicans, are less than even no party preference. So what does that tell you?
Well, the Republican registration has been diminishing, and we've seen rates of new registration at about 17% Republican, which means that they've been slowly getting smaller and smaller, and like you said, they've gone under no party preference now for the first time. But that's not the end of the story, because in an election like this, in a low turnout primary, their impact is outsized because they turn out more. So right now, we have over 2 million ballots that have been cast. 34% of them are from Republicans.
So Republicans are overperforming.
Yeah, in a state that is overwhelmingly Democratic. So it could be very interesting tomorrow to see what happens.
Absolutely.
Okay, well, stick around. You'll be with us for the rest of the hour. Paul Mitchell, Vice President of the Nonpartisan Political Data Incorporated. Coming up, Dianne Feinstein has been a California senator for nearly 26 years. She's facing a challenge from the left, from State Senator Kevin DeLeon. Is she facing a serious threat? That's next on Press Play. First, though, there are five propositions on the ballot. And throughout the show, KCRW's Benjamin Gottlieb is going to give us a crash course on each of them, beginning now with Prop 68.
Proposition 68 is a $4 billion bond for water and parks. They would allow the state to borrow that $4 billion to fund a variety of eco projects. So things like drinking water improvements, also new parks in low-income neighborhoods. Now, California would have to pay it back with interest, and it could cost the state an extra $200 million annually for the next four decades. Now, here's the argument from the yes on Prop 68 side. Our water infrastructure is aging, and it's not equipped to deal with the future, especially a warmer future because of climate change. So it's time, they say, to invest and to spread that borrowing over the next 40 years. Here's the argument from the no on Prop 68 side. We've already borrowed $15 billion on water projects since 2002. And future taxpayers, well, they're going to have ballooning pension payments to worry about. Most of all, they argue the state could tap into the surplus funds that we have right now rather than borrow more money. You're up to speed on Proposition 68. More of KCRW's election special is on the way on Press Play.
The other long list of candidates confronting voters on the ballot is for U.S. Senate. You're going to see 32 names on your ballot. One of them is, of course, Dianne Feinstein. California's senior senator is the comfortable frontrunner in her bid for another term. 36% of likely voters in a recent poll say they'll vote for her. But the race for second place is wide open. State Senator Kevin DeLeon is her leading Democratic challenger. And the LA-based politician has been touring the state trying to rally liberal enthusiasm. But in polls, he is just a couple percentage points ahead of a little-known Republican businessman. Meanwhile, Feinstein has moved to the left on some of her long-held moderate positions including the death penalty and marijuana. KCRW's Warren Olney sat down with Feinstein and DeLeon in the lead-up to the June primary, and he's here with me now. Hi there.
Hi. One of the principal questions, of course, for Senator Feinstein is, how come you've been in the Senate since the early 1990s? Why don't you move ahead? Why isn't it time to let somebody else get the job? I asked her that question. Here's how she responded.
Because there's so much left to do. And because in the Senate, seniority matters. And you percolate up through the seats. And so I percolated to ranking member on the Senate Judiciary Committee. And number three on a very large committee, which is the Appropriations Committee. So I can be helpful. And have been with transportation grants, both north and south, money and programs that might have not come about.
Okay, so she's 84. By the end of her term, if she wins again, she'll be 90.
That's right.
So did her younger challenger bring that up, Kevin DeLeon?
Well, he, of course, has to be very careful on this issue because you can't run against somebody because they're too old. That is just not acceptable. And yet, he addresses, for example, the seniority matters question by saying she's squandering her seniority. She hasn't done anything recently. Here's the way he talks about it.
Well, Warren, I would argue that seniority means nothing unless you use it. And seniority is not destiny because seniority doesn't guarantee results. This is about judgment. This is about courage. And this is about leadership. Arguably, two of her greatest accomplishments are the assault weapons ban as well as the Desert Protection Act, both measures she passed in 1994, 2 years after she was elected.
So basically, he said that since then, she's been a lame duck?
Well, obviously, he's claiming she's history, and that's the way he wants voters to think about it. But he, of course, a very controversial guy himself. He was very powerful in the state Senate as president pro tem of the state Senate. He was the author of the Sanctuary Cities legislation. He does have some baggage, but that's baggage that really appeals to the younger voters, the people that he thinks it's time to organize and get demobilized. And, of course, she has been responding to that. She claims that's not really the reason, but she has changed her position in favor of the death penalty. She's opposed to it now. She says he can make a lot of mistakes doing that, and she's learned a lot as she's gotten older. Mm-hmm. And also she's changed her position on recreational marijuana. She's now in favor of it. It's worth pointing out that in the Democratic convention, he got more votes than she did in terms of the idea of endorsement.
So the state party's supporting him, not her?
No, the state party, neither of them got enough votes to get support from the state party. So in that respect, it's up for grabs.
Well, okay, looking at the most recent polls, he's at 11%. And this guy that no one's heard of, this Republican, his name is James P. Bradley, is polling at 7%. So just a few percentage points behind. Here's what he said. He spoke to KCRW recently.
I was a non-party preferred for most of my voting history, and I started watching the change in the political climate. So I had to make a determination or a position of where I wanted to stand if I were to run. But that doesn't dismiss the fact that I do have the very similar values as the Republican platform.
So what does it say that he is running almost neck and neck with Kevin DeLeon, who has much bigger, I would assume, name recognition?
Well, different pollsters have different things to say. First of all, of course, he is at least a Republican. His name sounds kind of Anglo. One of the pollsters is saying that that is in his favor in this particular election, and probably an ugly reality if that's true. But nonetheless, that's what is being said. And he hasn't gotten the endorsement of the president as yet that I'm aware
and
of.
And I don't think he will.
Probably not.
Okay. Well, if he does make it to the number two spot, will he and Feinstein debate each other? Will they?
Well,
go
that's
ahead
a good
ahead?
Question. Feinstein has said she will debate, and it will be very interesting, of course, if she debates Kevin DeLeon, because once again, you'll have that issue of youth versus age. I don't think anybody knows if the Republican, hardly named, hardly known, is going to have that kind of clout and be able to get her into a debate, or if she'll just say, no way.
All right. Warren Olney, thank you very much.
Okay.
All right. Coming up, the attorney general's race. Javier Becerra has filed 35 lawsuits against the Trump administration. His main rival says he needs to refocus on in-state issues. But first, here's KCRW's Benjamin Gottlieb.
Proposition 69 is a lockbox on the state's gas tax. It's something that by now you've probably heard a lot about. California's new gas tax, or you've seen it at the pump. It's that hike to the state's gasoline and diesel tax, and also a few new vehicle fees on your car or your truck. What this would do is make sure that that money, some $5 billion per year, is only spent on transportation projects, and it's not going to cost a thing. So who's for Prop 69? Well, two lawmakers pushed this ballot measure as a way to assure taxpayers that their money is being spent wisely. This way, Sacramento can guarantee that the funding is flowing to what it was intended for, the argument goes. Who's against Prop 69? Well, it's Californians who think the state should have never, ever passed that gas tax in the first place. And they say promising not to misappropriate that money is just not enough. You're up to speed now on Proposition 69. More of KCRW's election special is next.
This is Press Play. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Now we want to look at the attorney general's race. The incumbent, Javier Becerra, has been in office since 2017. Governor Jerry Brown appointed him shortly after the inauguration of President Donald Trump. Now, the governor and state leaders saw the need for a legal heavy hitter in the role, given the issues that Trump had campaigned on. Becerra has filed close to three dozen lawsuits against the administration since he's been in office. The state has won more than a third of them. Most of them, though, are still pending. His challengers, however, in the AG's race say Becerra has been hyper-focused on national positioning and not focused enough on California. And Becerra faces three challengers in the race, two Republicans and one Democrat. Donald Thompson is a reporter for the Associated Press. He's based in Sacramento. Donald, welcome.
Good to be here.
You bet. Becerra has fought Trump on immigration and the environment and health care and net neutrality. And, I mean, the list goes on and on. Do voters think he is focusing too much on the Trump administration?
Analysts I've talked to say that this is something that resonates with voters. So they're sort of giving him the benefit here that this is what they want to see. It grabs headlines. He's in the news frequently. He's able to sort of lay out his agenda here, and because of the nature of what he's doing and the nature of office, he gets a head start here over his fellow challengers because of what he's doing.
Is it unusual, though, for the AG, a California Attorney General, to base an election campaign on opposing the president?
California, I think, is trying to take that position and make itself the what Texas was, I guess, to the Obama administration. California, I think, in many ways, they see themselves as doing that with the Trump administration. And certainly when Becerra was appointed and when he was going through his confirmation hearing, that was seemed to be what the lawmakers wanted. And he's, I think, in his mind, certainly trying to fulfill that at this point.
Now, Becerra's main challenger is Democrat Dave Jones, the outgoing state insurance commissioner. He filed a suit a couple of weeks ago claiming that Becerra's campaign used a state courthouse as a backdrop for a campaign commercial going against state campaign law. How far can that suit go?
The courts will take it up here and figure what they want to do with it. General Becerra basically says that he had the proper, or his campaign says that they had the proper permission, and argues that he used the same courthouse that you or I could use if we had the proper permits. Mr. Jones and his attorneys say, well, yeah, but you know, state law trumps that and says you can't use this for a campaign commercial for political office. So we'll see how that plays out here at this point.
So that lawsuit could go on, seemingly, like if Becerra and Jones are the top two vote getters, that could keep going, right?
Yeah, well, presumably it could keep going either way, but if he continues maintaining it, it would not be moot. So they would at some point hash this out.
Republican challenger Eric Early also filed suit against Becerra in late May, arguing that he is ineligible to be attorney general. What's that argument, and how much weight does it have?
I think it's a way of, and several of the other candidates have said the same thing, that Becerra spent most of his recent decades in Congress and is now circling back and becoming attorney general, and they try to question his experience. This is another way of doing that. It says basically that he was not actively practicing law for a number of years, and now is, the suit claims that he's ineligible as a result. It's not the first time this has happened. There was a similar gambit against Jerry Brown when he was attorney general, and it did not go anywhere. Jerry Brown went on and became, you know, was the attorney general and took that as a stepping stone to the governor's mansion again for the second time in Brown's case.
There's also another Republican in the race. This is Stephen Bailey, a former Superior Court judge. No lawsuit from him, I assume. What are the candidates saying, not only about Becerra's shortcomings, but of what they would bring to the attorney general's office?
We've got Becerra is certainly a progressive or liberal Democrat, but you've got Dave Jones, the insurance commissioner, who's trying to run to his left. He's saying that he would not only sue Trump as much as Becerra would sue him more, but he says he would have done a better job at it. He would have sued earlier and that sort of thing. He also says that Becerra is not doing enough on other fronts, you know, collecting guns from those who can't afford to have them, helping out on the opioid crisis, things along that line that he says he would do better if he's elected. Then you've got the two Republicans who, not surprisingly, are running to Becerra's right, and they're saying they would do, you know, not sue Trump as much, that some of this is frivolous, that California should not be an outlier in some of this national policy agenda. And, for instance, they support the death penalty. Becerra and Jones both have qualms about that, although Becerra is currently trying to get it reinstated here in California.
Donald Thompson, AP reporter based in Sacramento. Donald, thank you for your time.
Good talking with you.
Coming up, will the Democrats be able to turn vulnerable Republican House seats? A crowded field could spell their doom. That's next on Press Play. First, though, let's go to Benjamin Gottlieb for another Proposition Explainer.
Proposition 70 is a future spending plan for California's cap and trade program. And here's how it would work. Any money raised by the state's carbon auction after the year 2024 would be frozen. And the only way it could be unfrozen and spent is if lawmakers come up with a spending plan, a plan that two-thirds of them get behind. Basically, cap and trade restricts the amount that businesses can pollute and then auctions off the right to pollute up to that limit. And the money goes to things like public transit and affordable housing. So who is for Prop 70? Well, this is on the ballot because of Governor Jerry Brown and a compromise he made with the former Assembly Republican leader Chad Mays. Brown was able to get the cap and trade program extended to 2030, and Mays got this proposition. Now, who's against Prop 70? It's environmental groups who fear that requiring a two-thirds vote to spend all this money instead of the simple majority would lead to weaker climate policy. The LA Times, for its part, calls it a, quote, so-called reform measure that serves little or no purpose. You're up to speed now on Proposition 70. Let's get back to KCRW's election special.
You're listening to KCRW's election special on Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand, along with Steve Chiatakis. The Democrats' mission to turn the House of Representatives blue may come down to California, and some California voters know that.
I've really just started my research, honestly. I know it's a primary. It's going to be interesting to see, I guess, in places like Orange County or even just outside of Los Angeles where they're pretty Republican and there are lots of Democrats on the ticket, to see if one can poke through.
So the election is extremely important to many people, and it's also important to the Republicans. And it seems to come down to a matter of, is Mr. Trump doing the job, of which in California most of us say he is not doing the job.
That's Dan Mitrovich and Rebecca Rice in a very unofficial sampling of California voters at a coffee shop in Culver City today, where the vast majority said they were really not aware of or had nothing to say about tomorrow's election.
Not aware of the election. Now, as Rebecca mentioned, Madeline, the top two primary system could be throwing sand in the gears, with many, many Democrats fighting to get through the so-called jungle primary. Here to help us break down some of the key races are Luis Alvarado, a Republican strategist and co-founder of Grow Elect, a Latino Republican PAC. Hi, Luis.
Hi, it's a pleasure being here.
Yeah, thanks for being here. Max Zilber is a Democratic consultant and founding partner at Jacobson and Zilber Strategies. During this primary, he's worked for Democrats Andy Thorburn and Harley Ruda in the 39th and 48th district house races. Thanks for being here.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
You bet.
Okay, Luis, let's begin with you. Voters in half of the 14 House seats currently held by Republicans here in California, they went for Hillary Clinton in the last presidential election. So how worried are Republicans about losing some or all of these seats in this election?
I wouldn't use the word worried. I would say cautious, optimistically cautious, because, you know, you can't compare a presidential election turnout to a midterm election. Specifically, different people come out to vote. Different things are in people's minds. And when we look at the return ballots so far this week, we're kind of confident to see that you have a 4-to-1 differential between millennials voting and over 50-year-old people voting. 4-to-1 is significant because most of the people that are voting are Republicans. So that allows them to close the gap with Democrats.
So 4-to-1 seniors voting over millennials. Is that what you're saying?
That is correct.
Okay, so that's good for Republicans. Let's talk about what's happening in Orange County. We have Mimi Walters, Dana Rohrabacher looking for re-election, Daryl Issa, Ed Royce retiring. What's the strategy for Republicans to hold on to those seats?
Get two Republicans past the primary. That's the golden ticket right there. Then after that, then let them battle it out to see which is the best Republican. But for now, it's just make sure that we dilute the vote from the Democrats, and I'm sure that the Democrat party chair is pulling his hair because there's so many Democrats running and they won't listen to him.
Well, let's talk about that, and we'll bring in Max Zilber, who's the Democratic consultant, to tell us about your work, Mac, trying to put Democrat Harley Ruda and Dana Rohrabacher's seat. What's the strategy from your side of things?
Well, the key here is twofold. The first is to educate voters that a number of candidates who are appearing on the ballot have actually dropped out. Laura Oatman, Rachel Payne, and Michael Kotick are all on the ballot in the 48th Congressional District as Democrats, and yet they've all dropped out. Oatman and Kotick have both endorsed Ruda. So a large piece is educational because there's actually only a couple of Democrats left who are still really mounting campaigns. The concern is that those folks who remain on the ballot can serve as spoilers. So it's really talking about Harley Ruda's affirmative message on expanding access to health care, protecting the environment, and other issues that are resonating in a coastal district like the 48th.
Well, now you just talked about the 48th district where Democrats have bowed out, but in the 39th district, that is not exactly the case. And I know in this Politico story from over the weekend, another candidate called it the weirdest race in the country. You are consulting the Democrat in the race, Andy Thorburn. And I got to ask you the question, because the National Party, the DCCC, is not behind your candidate, but your candidate is still in this with so many other Democrats in the race. Isn't the larger goal of getting a Democrat in there, period?
The goal is absolutely getting a Democrat in there, and Andy Thorburn has led or tied for the lead among Democrats in every public poll that we've seen. Andy is one of the top fundraisers in the country among Democrats, and on the issues, he really lines up with the values of the 39th Congressional District.
Despite what the DCCC says, though.
Right. Well, and Andy has earned the support of a number of large organizations that Democratic voters trust, the California Nurses Association, Our Revolution. And so, yes, there's going to be instances in which groups split. But by and large, we feel that if Andy and Harley get to the general elections in these districts, the Democrats are largely favored to win the elections. The tricky thing is getting past that initial split primary field, which is why Democrats really have to consolidate around the Democratic candidates who have the best chance of winning.
Okay, Luis, let's go inland and talk about the Steve Knight district. He has been called by roll call perhaps the most vulnerable Republican. And so he's facing a few Democrats, including a newcomer named Katie Hill. She's 29 years old. And so why is he in such trouble?
Because he had a close election the last time on the go around. The district itself is turning more Democrat, a little bit younger. So he has to. He had a big task to reconnect with his district in this last 2 years, to make sure that that he was able to prove that he was the best representative for the district. The Democrats obviously are spending a ton of money to make sure to paint him as a pro-Trump guy, and I don't think that strategy works, because you know, just saying, hey, that guy's a pro-Trump guy, he's a because he's a Republican, doesn't actually work anymore. I mean, myself, I'm not a Trump guy, but I actually can make can ensure you that these candidates are actually connecting with the district. And that's the strategy they have to focus on if they're going to win, because at the end of the day, money can only go so far. If they don't connect, if the money doesn't connect with the voters' issues, it's not going to help them resonate.
Well, one of the big issues is immigration, especially in that part of the world. So how do the Republican candidates kind of thread the needle there, where their party has taken a pretty hardline stance when it comes to the border wall, when it comes to immigration policies promoted by the Trump administration, and yet you've got a lot of Latino voters in the Central Valley.
And that's a perfect example for Steve Knight, who actually bucked the party and signed on to a movement in the Hill to actually have a vote on DACA and actually trying to reform immigration reform. So that's where he actually connects with the district and issues that are important to those voters. And it doesn't take a cue from what Washington is telling him as a Republican that he should be voting.
What about Jeff Denham in the 10th?
Well, Jeff Denham has been an arduous supporter of immigration reform. Jeff Denham actually knows the district. He himself goes into the farms and talks to everybody, not just the farm workers, the farm owners, but and the vendors. He actually is one of the guys who is best loved from, and I'm use that word not very loosely, loved by his people in that district. They know Jeff Denham, and so when people come out from the outside, for say, and actually try to convince him that he's a bad guy, they've been unsuccessful for many, many past campaign cycles.
So why is that race a toss-up?
Because of demographic changes. And he has to continue to talk to the constituents. And if there is a crack or the demographics seem that there's an opportunity, there's some guy at a DCCC and a cubicle somewhere in Maryland who's saying, you know, we got to put money in here because we can win it, but actually don't have the feelers because, I mean, Dolores Huerta's son was out there trying to get elected, and the fact that he was the son of Dolores Huerta didn't have any effect on these candidates who actually do a great job of representing the district.
I suspect there are plenty of cubicles at the RCCC as well, so in Maryland, for that matter. So, Max Zilber, I got to ask you, is immigration a winning issue? That's what we're talking about. Central Valley, for a lot of the workers, the farm workers, is it a winning issue for Democrats this go around? Or the converse, you know, ideology is, you know, is President Trump emboldening Republicans?
So it's a double-pronged issue because on the one hand, the DACA and the Dreamers broadly is a good space for Democrats to be in. At the same time, when we're talking about immigration more broadly as an issue, we might not be talking about our strongest wedge. Healthcare, the environment, a couple other issues are generally testing a little bit better. Gun control is currently riling folks up more. However, in the Central Valley, the Democrats' biggest problem has never been persuasion. It's been turnout. I mean, the David Valadao seat, which Luis mentioned, which, you know, Emilio Huerta lost by 15 points, that's something like a Democrat plus 20 seat. But David Valadao wins big each cycle, partially because he wins a large portion of Democrats and partially because Democrats have a real hard time turning folks out. It's almost the
turning
inverse
folks out in a midterm election, turning in an off-year election, right?
Especially in an off-year election. It's kind of the inverse of, in Orange County, turnout doesn't tend to be the Dems' problem, especially in districts like the 48th and the 49th. It's persuasion. There actually are Republican registration advantages there. In the Central Valley, it's all about turnout and specifically turning out Latino voters and younger voters especially.
You know, the one thing you mentioned, all these issues, gun control and health care and all these issues that the Democrats are running on, immigration, obviously, but it doesn't seem like this goes for like nationwide. It doesn't seem like the Democrats have a cohesive measure. Some sort of mantra going in. Like, what are they talking about as far as, you know, what they're going to provide if they do gain the leadership of the House of Representatives?
Well, I think one area that Luis is absolutely right is that you've got to talk to the specific district that you're campaigning in. When you look at any historical wave election, you don't have just one type of candidate getting elected. You have candidates getting elected who represent their specific districts. And there's going to be districts where you're going to win by winning over those Romney Clinton voters, those kind of more upscale, educated moderates. And there's going to be districts that you're going to win by pursuing a more Bernie populist message. And, you know, the biggest advantage and disadvantage the Democrats have right now is how big a tent they are. It's an advantage because it means they can kind of fit into an unusual number of districts, and it's a disadvantage because it means that we have a whole lot of candidates on the ballot in a lot of these districts.
I'd like to jump in just for a second there.
Just a few seconds.
It's actually the economy. I mean, Mac and I were talking about the economy. How do you dispute the success of the economy in regards to the differentiation between the environment and what the Democrats stand for? I think that is a big problem for Democrats coming into this midterm election.
Okay, great. Republican strategist Luis Alvarado, Democratic strategist Mac Zilber, thank you both.
Thank you
for the inviting.
And we're joined again by Paul Mitchell. He is the vice president of Political Data Incorporated, which provides voter information to both parties. So what do you make of what you just heard? The Republicans sound pretty confident.
Well, and they have a good reason to feel confident. This is a gubernatorial election cycle, and historically, Republicans do better in gubernatorial cycles because it's lower turnout. And when turnout drops in California, it doesn't drop evenly among all people. It drops precipitously among young and minority voters, people who live in apartments, lower income. And in fact, if you're a 65-year-old white homeowner, you're probably high turnout in every election.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the history upon which I think you have to kind of think of this election cycle. And from there, you can move into, well, it's more excitement on the Democratic side. There's an anti-Trump blue wave nationally. And what do all those things mean to adjust from that beginning point?
Right. And we heard Luis say that he's happy that older Republicans are voting and the millennials are not.
Well, somebody's happy that young people aren't voting. I guess Luis is staking that claim.
Yeah.
But he's absolutely right. At Political Data, we've been tracking and making data available to the public to look at, where you can dive into any district, any city around the state of California and see the turnout. And you can see it broken down by ethnicity and age and even see maps, precinct-level maps of where people are turning out. And voters 18 to 35-year-old are about a quarter of the electorate, and seniors are about a quarter of the electorate. But seniors are half of the ballots that have been returned. They've come from seniors. And 18 to 35-year-olds only account for 9% of the ballots that have been returned. So you see this huge demographic age function within the voting population. And if that extends to Election Day or something close to that on Election Day, then I think these Republican candidates have a lot of reason to feel safe.
Well, I mean, and are those folks, like, will the millennials show up tomorrow? Will seniors show up tomorrow? They get their ballots in early, but will they go to the polls?
Yeah, that's a challenge. And more young people are electing to become vote by mail. But of the 18 to 35-year-olds, two-thirds of them have never mailed in a ballot for any election. And so this change in the mechanics of how people are voting is happening, but we're still waiting to find out if young people are going to vote on Election Day, and that could change everything. Right now we're seeing a turnout of a population that is heavily senior, that's 13% Latino, that is advantaging the Bay Area by about 12 points.
Huh.
And is that going to be reversed by a big wave of young people and Latinos and Angelenos on Election Day? We don't know.
Young people love to go, and they, as we talked about off air, they love to march. They love to go out into the streets, right, put the hats on and the big signage and all of that stuff. But are they emboldened in this era of Trump, in the resistance, are they emboldened to go to the polls?
And that's been a challenge, not just in Tuesday's election, but in the past elections we've had since Trump got elected. We haven't seen young people turning out in the same numbers as you would expect from their participation in, as an example, the marches and rallies.
Yeah. If only they could vote by text.
Or vote by signpost.
Yeah, no nefarious things could happen in that respect. Right?
No hacking
at
all.
No hacking at all. Paul Mitchell will, of course, keep you around for just a moment. Coming up, we're going to be back to talk about how Sacramento passed gas tax could have one state senator fighting to keep his job. But first, KCRW's Benjamin Gottlieb explains another thing you will see when you vote.
Proposition 71 is a ballot measure about ballot measures. It would change when propositions actually become law. Now, as it stands right now, when a majority of us vote yes on a proposition, it becomes law the next day. Prop 71 would move that back, and bear with me, to the fifth day after the Secretary of State certifies the election results. Okay, so here's an example. Legalization of recreational marijuana passed by voter initiative on November 8th of 2016, and it became law the next day, on the 9th. Under Proposition 71, pot would have been legalized more than 5 weeks later, December 17th. Okay, so who's for Prop 71? The California Democratic Party, for one, the argument being that this will avoid unnecessary confusion in the event of a very close race. Against Prop 71? Well, there's no formal opposition, but you will find an argument in your voter guide, and it goes like this. California's direct democracy is working, and this proposition is a solution in search of a problem. That's Proposition 71. Time for more of KCRW's Election Special.
All right. Thank you, Benjamin. Also on the ballot tomorrow is a recall election, at least if you're a voter in California's 29th Senate District. That's southeast of L.A. It covers parts of L.A., Orange, and San Bernardino counties. California State Senator Josh Newman is the incumbent Republicans are trying to recall. And if they succeed, Democrats could lose their supermajority in the state legislature. Paul Mitchell is back, Vice President of Political Data, Inc. Hello. Okay. What is the justification for this recall?
Well, ostensibly, this is a recall about the gas tax. But for those who have been watching it, it's really not about the gas tax. It's about the two-thirds majority the Democrats have in the state legislature and the Senate. And that two-thirds majority was actually kind of a surprise for Democrats. In 2016, the high turnout for Democrats launched Josh Newman in the primary into the general election. And then out of the general election, he beat Lingling Chang, who's now running as a part of this recall. And that gift to Democrats now is the Republicans are trying to take that back away with a recall election. And they were smart enough to realize that a recall election, if you were to poll every voter in this district, probably wouldn't pass. But when we talk about low turnout and we talk about the kind of turnout we're seeing in that district that is about 10 points more Republican than its own registration rate, that's the kind of environment where this kind of thing could be successful and they could end up taking away from Democrats that two-thirds majority that they want to pass.
Right, but why Newman? He wasn't the only one who voted for this gas tax.
I think they see him, rightly so, as being probably the most vulnerable senator. He was the most recently elected. He's only been in office for 2 years, or less than 2 years, 18 months or so. And his election, like I said, was a surprise to Democrats at the time. This was a Republican-held seat until 2016, and it was just that big wave with the Hillary and Trump election that kind of got him into office, and barely. It was down to the last few days of counting ballots until he really knew he was in that seat. And I guess he didn't know at that point how precarious that would be.
The Republicans really seized on this gas tax, right? And the strategy, as you mentioned, about a recall is to find this issue. Ask Gray Davis about recalls and whether, you know, there is strategy in finding whatever that someone can oppose. And, and Gray Davis, of course, was recalled out of office, and then hence the catapulting of Arnold Schwarzenegger. So how unpopular is this? Is this a la, you know, early aughts of the 2000s, or is this something where, oh, it's the gas tax, we're getting better roads, we're really not that concerned about it?
Yeah, I think that they're independent issues. Around the state, there is going to be a repeal of the gas tax measure up in November, and we're really going to get to understand where voters are at. But in terms of this race, it seems as though this is a partisan exercise. And if you're a Republican, it's a great partisan exercise, and you want to be successful. If you're a Democrat, you want to hold on to this member of the state Senate. But it is, I think, useful as a tool to say that it's about the gas tax. But really what it's going to come down to is Republicans are going to vote for the recall and Democrats are going to vote against it. And independents are going to be that kind of, you know, that's where they're going to be fighting over those voters. And if we have turnout in this election that is higher in Republican turnout because it's a gubernatorial cycle and where there's depressed turnout among young people and Latinos in this district like we've seen so far, then I think it's going to be very tough for him to survive this recall. Mm.
And then what happens if the Democrats lose their supermajority?
Well, if the Democrats lose their supermajority, they'll obviously try in other districts to go get it. Right now, there's going to be a competitive state Senate race in Orange County. Janet Nguyen is a sitting Republican state senator, and former Assemblyman Tom Umberg is going to be running for that seat. So they're not just going to pack up their marbles and go home. They're going to try to win that two-thirds majority back some other way. And going into 2020, I'm sure that they're going to try to expand it.
All right. Paul Mitchell, Vice President of Political Data Incorporated, a bipartisan voter data firm. Thank you so much for joining us.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
Before we go, one more proposition to tell you about. Here is KCRW's Benjamin Gottlieb.
Proposition 72 is a proposal to let you capture stormwater tax-free. You may be thinking, isn't rain free already? Well, not quite. When a piece of property is reassessed, improvements made into it are factored in. So things like adding a new room or building a deck. Now, right now, certain modifications are excluded, like solar panels, and Prop 72 would add a stormwater capture system to those exclusions. This would not cost the state much unless this type of water system becomes more and more popular. The argument for Prop 72 is as follows. The state should encourage you to conserve water, and collecting rain for drier months is a positive step. But right now, state property tax rules are actively discouraging that behavior. There are no formal arguments against Prop 72 that you will find on your official voter guide. And that is it for your rundown of the five state propositions on your primary ballot. I'm Benjamin Gottlieb.
That's it for our special election coverage on Press Play. Now it's your turn to go out and vote. Polls are open tomorrow between 7 a.m. and 8 p.m. right here in the great state of California. I'm Steve Chiatakis.
And I'm Madeline Brand. Thanks for listening. I'll see you tomorrow.